Well, we are going to be discussing episodes out of the book of Daniel, just like all the other classes. Just so you know, you won't always be on the same page as what your kids are in class studying. Some of the classrooms are set up for one specific lesson. I think everybody's doing this lesson today, but after today, so tomorrow we'll be studying about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in here. No, they won't. They're going to be doing Daniel 2 in here, the image. Some of the classes will be studying about the image. Some of the classes will be studying about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Some of them will be studying about Daniel and the lion's den. But just so you know, you won't always be in the same page as what your kids are doing in class. I'm going to be teaching this morning and Wednesday night, and then Brother Patton's going to be teaching tomorrow and Wednesday morning. So, all right. Well, everybody, let's get out your Bibles and let's go to Daniel chapter 1. We're going to start there, and we're also going to look at a fair amount of context leading up to our study here. Before we do that, let's start with a word of prayer. Brother John, would you lead us in a word of prayer to get started? Amen. Daniel begins on an ominous note. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. And of course, from there, we'll read about some of the young men that were taken, Daniel being one of them. Many of the prophets, and here at university we've been studying through the prophets, and we've been looking at these messages of judgment that God gave through the prophets about what was going to be coming if the people did not repent and turn. When you begin reading Daniel, you see the outcome of the people's unfaithfulness. The Jews have been taken away into captivity, or at least that has begun anyway. That's actually my first question. Why did this all happen? When you come to Daniel and you see about the Babylonian king coming and besieging Jerusalem, even taking articles from the temple and taking those back and putting them in the house of his God, why did all this come about? God's judgment. God's judgment. Deuteronomy 28 is a useful passage in so many ways because it gives a synopsis of what would happen to Israel in their history. Deuteronomy 28 is this passage that occurs before Israel goes into the land of Canaan and takes possession of it. And God is reminding them in the first 14 verses of Deuteronomy chapter 28 that if they would follow Him, then they're going to be blessed. They're going to have this land of plenty. All their needs are going to be met. They're going to be successful militarily. Everything will be great. But then starting in verse 15 of Deuteronomy 28 and going through the rest of the chapter, there are these warnings. When, if you turn away from me, then things are not going to go so well. It talks about famine, it talks about plagues, it talks about military defeat. And when you read and study the Old Testament history of Israel, you see how all those things came about very quickly. You know, after Joshua leads them into conquest, what's the next period of history in the Bible? Book after Joshua. Judges. How good are things in Israel during the time of the judges? Pretty rotten. The people keep on turning away from God and they keep on suffering because of that. Then you have the kingdom, and Saul initially is good, but then he turns from God, and they are again experiencing military defeat at the hands of the Philistines. David is righteous, and so he extends the borders. Solomon extends the borders. But then after the death of Solomon, the kingdom divides. And most of that history with the divided kingdom is Israel and Judah are very weak. They are suffering. They are being defeated. Till ultimately, and this again in Deuteronomy chapter 28, God has had enough. And while He had brought them into the promised land, He is now taking them out of the promised land. So He says in Deuteronomy 28 and verses 63 through 68, here was kind of the last, if you will, the culminating curse that would come upon the people if they were to turn away from Him. It shall come about that as the Lord delighted over you to prosper you and multiply you, so the Lord will delight over you to make you perish and destroy you. And you'll be torn from the land where you are entering to possess it. Moreover, the Lord will scatter you among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth. And there you shall serve other gods, wood and stone, which you or your fathers have not known. Among those nations you shall find no rest, and there will be no resting place for the sole of your foot. But there the Lord will give you a trembling heart, failing of eyes, and despair of soul. So your life shall hang in doubt before you, and you'll be in dread night and day, and shall have no assurance of your life. In the morning you shall say, "Would that it were evening," and at the evening you shall say, "Would that it were morning," because of the dread of your heart which you dread, and for the sight of your eyes which you will see. Now, verse 68 is of particular interest. Remember, this is written to not the generation that came out of Egypt, but the next generation. But they know their fathers, their parents had been in Egypt in slavery and had been brought out of Egypt. Well, here's what God says. The Lord will bring you back to Egypt in ships. By the way about which I spoke to you, you will never see it again. And there you will offer yourself for sale to your enemies as male and female slaves, but there will be no buyer. They don't really have any history of the Lord's people going back into captivity to Egypt. I think that's figurative. You were brought out of Egypt. You were in slavery in Egypt. I delivered you. I said you're never going back there. But if and when you turn from me and I remove you from your land, you're going back to Egypt. You're going back into captivity. Well, by the time we get to Daniel, and again, we've had this divided kingdom, Israel in the north and Judah in the south. Israel has already been taken from their land. Anybody know who took the Israelites, the northern kingdom, out of their land? The Assyrians. They had been the dominant world power for the last couple of hundred years. In fact, when you look at this map, you see I don't know if my pointer just doesn't work or it doesn't show up on that green. Ah, dead battery. Triple A's, Jeff. Anyway, if you see there where it has Babylonia and Assyria, you see those two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates River. Many of you are already familiar with the Bible geography. Anyone want to tell us what current nation that would be? Iraq. Yes, Iraq is where the land of Mesopotamia in the Old Testament was. The two rivers still flow through Iraq. And both of these ancient empires would have had their home in modern-day Iraq. We'll get the pointer here in just a second. John, let me let you to hand this to Jeff, and you can bring it back to me. There's the old batteries. All right. Well, as we mentioned, for the last couple of hundred years, Assyria, the power there in the north, had been dominant. Babylon had also been there, and there were times in which Babylon had kind of regained some strength. But for the most part, Assyria was the dominant power. You even get some notion of this in the text. So, for instance, in 2 Kings chapter 20. 2 Kings chapter 20, this is after... Thank you, John. You remember that Hezekiah had had this illness and the Lord had granted him 15 more years of life. After this, you see in verse 12 of 2 Kings chapter 20, at that time, Baradok, or your translation may read Merodach Baladan, a son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he heard that Hezekiah had been sick. Well, this is a time, and if you didn't see it on the map, right here in the southern eastern portion is Babylon. Up here is the Assyrian capital of Nineveh. Well, in this instance, Babylon had again exerted some independence, exerted some power. There's an actual king in Babylon that sends emissaries to Hezekiah. But in the days of Hezekiah's son, Manasseh, some of you are familiar with the text in 2 Chronicles 33, Manasseh had rebelled against Assyria, and the Assyrians took him captive, and do you know where they brought him and imprisoned him? Babylon. So what that tells you is, even though Babylon had been a kingdom during the days of Hezekiah, when you get to the days of Manasseh, his son, Assyria is again exerting control over Babylon, so much so that they can take captives and imprison them there in Babylon. Well, again, Assyria had been the dominant power, but when you come toward the days of Daniel, Babylon had again exerted its power and had risen. So there was a battle at Asher and then at Nineveh, all in the early, somewhere around 615 B.C. The Assyrians were being defeated again and again. You see up here, at Carchemish, right there. A couple things happened there. Josiah is known to us as really the last faithful king of Judah. Josiah is the one that wanted to restore the temple, and while the temple is being restored, you remember they found a copy of the Book of the Law. They read that, they recognized how sinful they were, how they turned against God, and so they made a lot of reforms. Well, Josiah was very trusting in God, but he also did one thing that was very foolish. The Egyptian king, the Egyptian pharaoh, was making his way up to Carchemish to support the Assyrians. Now, Josiah had more or less thrown off the yoke of Assyria. He was not going to allow them to be a dominant power, and so he thought he could delay or hinder the Egyptian forces making their way up to support the Assyrians. Josiah dies in battle at Megiddo, there in Palestine. Well, the Egyptians will ultimately make their way up to Carchemish, and they're going to be defeated there. The map here says 609. That was one battle. That was the time when Josiah died. But the Babylonian forces are overwhelmingly successful in about 605 BC. And what they do is they chase the Egyptian forces all the way back down to Egypt, defeating their army. Well, Carchemish is here. That's where the battle had happened. Egypt is here. What's on the way? Israel's on the way. Jerusalem is on the way. Now, the Jerusalem kings had been playing a little bit of political football over the last few generations. Various kings had tried to support whatever world power they thought was going to be dominant. And the current Jerusalem king had actually been set up on the throne by the Egyptian pharaoh, Jehoiakim. Well, the Babylonian king says, I'm not going to allow anyone to be in power that is allied to another power. He comes to Jerusalem. And Jehoiakim is king. And Jehoiakim, it says in chapter 24 and verse 1, Jehoiakim serves the Babylonian king for 3 years. Well, that's the Babylonian king's first excursion to Jerusalem. It was in 605. And that is when Daniel and his friends and many others from Palestine were taken captive. That's how we get to Babylon being the world power. Nebuchadnezzar is now the king of Babylon, and Israel is now subject to Babylon. And so while the Babylonians had not yet destroyed Israel, did not destroy Jerusalem, that will happen. Jehoiakim is going to die. His son is going to be taken captive in 597. Many of the Jewish people will be taken captive in 597. And then in about 586, Jerusalem and the temple are completely destroyed by the Babylonians. Anyway. That gets us to Daniel. I don't think I have. Alright, so, just give you an idea. I was talking about this with my wife last night, and she talked about how for Daniel and his friends, something she was reading, it would have been a 500-mile march through the desert. Well, if they were taken directly from Jerusalem to Babylon, that would have been the case. Probably not what happened. Anybody know what current nation is in this area? Saudi Arabia. And what's this Historically speaking, what's this area known as? The Arabian what? Desert. Yeah, you don't march through the desert. Most people don't anyway. So that's why even on most of your maps, it will have them making the journey up and then down, which, by the way, interesting, I don't think coincidence, but symmetry in the Bible. Who had begun a journey from here, from Ur? Abraham. Now, he ultimately makes it over to Palestine, but where does he go first? Anybody remember? Haran. Yeah, Haran. Okay, so Haran is up here and then down. You see that Daniel and the captives are making the journey in reverse. Abraham went from Mesopotamia and went to the Promised Land. The captives leave the Promised Land and reverse course, making the same journey. That's about a 1,000-mile journey from Babylon and Ur to Jerusalem. All right, we'll get to that in just a little bit. Let's go through the story, though. I think most of us know the story here in chapter 1 pretty well. Daniel and his friends, and remind me, what time? Is it 11:05, Jeff? Yeah. All right, chances are we're not going to still be talking at 11:05. I'm just going to let you know that. All right. So Daniel and his friends are brought into captivity. Let's just start reading in verse 3. The king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including sons of the royal family and the nobles. We are not told what relation Daniel has to any of these families. He could have been of royal lineage. Certainly would seem he was of noble lineage. That's those who were taken captive at this time. Youths in whom there was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. And he ordered him to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. Now, this is an interesting kind of a side note here as well. What are the Chaldeans famed for? And even think in your New Testaments. Who was it that visited the baby or the young Jesus from the east? Wise men. Now we think of wise men as, people who are just learned, and no doubt these men were too. But what did a lot of that Eastern wisdom rely on? Mysticism, magic, astrology, okay? That's what the Chaldeans were famed for. And so you'll actually find this throughout the book of Daniel. You'll have the magicians, the sorcerers, the astrologers. They're called in to bring advice to the king, and they fail. Well, that's the kind of wisdom that they're wanting to train Daniel and his friends in. It's not just, okay, you know, make sure you know your math, make sure you understand Babylonian dialect. That would have been there too. But astrology, reading the stars, understanding how to make predictions, how to read dreams, all those kinds of things, that's some of the things that Daniel and his friends were taught. So this was so that they have ability to serve in the king's court. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Among these, from the sons of Judah, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And the commander of the officials assigned new names to them, and to Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. We're going to talk about the significance of those names here in just a little while. But when you come to verse 8, here is where the drama and the action in our story takes place. Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. Now, when you read that, what is it that first comes into our mind? Why would Daniel refuse this food?
Wasn't good for him.
And that's a very likely scenario. This would have been unclean food. So as you see, as our decorators, the happy pigs up there, I would happily go home and eat one right now, But for Daniel, that's a no-no. That may not be the whole story, though. Was wine forbidden the Jews? No. That wasn't forbidden the Jews. Unless, you know, it's possible, I guess, that the fermentation level of the king's wine was so great that that would have been a defiling thing. So it could just be that this was unclean food, but it doesn't necessarily explain all of it. What would that food on the king's table, who would it have been dedicated to? Not just the king, but who else? Who? Their gods. That may be another aspect of this, and I think kind of plays into the story as a whole, as we'll conclude here after a while. That not only is this food that for a conscientious Jew, he would not have partaken of because it was unclean, but this actually even gets into some of the elements in the New Testament in Paul's letter to the Corinthians, you know, that while the Christians understood that meat in and of itself was not defiled, what prohibition did Paul give those saints in Corinth about eating of meat? Were they to eat in an idol's temple and also partake of the Lord's Supper? No, that's something that no one's conscience should be able to withstand. To eat this food that was given over to idols, dedicated to them, even if you understood that the idol was nothing, and yet just because of the significance of that and the celebration that was given to these false gods, no, don't do this, okay? That may have been a large part of what Daniel's dealing with here as well. Unclean for him, but also food that's dedicated to a false god. So, Daniel has a request. What does he want instead?
Vegetation diet.
I do not understand how at the end of this he's fatter than the rest unless he ate a lot of avocados. But give us vegetables. Do you remember Daniel asked that they be tested in this way for how long? 10 days. Does a testing of 10 days ring any bells? What does Revelation 2 and verse 10 say? We remember the be faithful until death part of Revelation 2 and verse 10. What else does it say? Andy, when you get there, read that for me.
Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison that you may be tested.
Revelation, which certainly pulls from so many images from the Old Testament, that may be a direct allusion to even Daniel's testing here. What's being tested? Yeah, it's Daniel's reliance on God. Give me 10 days. And we're going to see if this works out. And that 10-day, it's not a test of God, it's a test of, will Daniel commit himself to doing this? And so much in the same way as John's letter, or Jesus' letter to the church here in Revelation 2 and verse 10, you're going to have a lot of tribulation. You're going to be tested. It's going to be a 10-day test. Would they rely on their God throughout that 10-day? Well, Daniel says, you know, that's what we're willing to do. Just give us vegetables to eat. All right. Let's see if we can make that work. Okay. Chapter 1 begins with the Babylonian king. He has gone to Jerusalem. He has besieged it. He's, you know, defeated the king. But then it makes it very clear in verse 2. What does the Babylonian king do? What does he raid? He raids the temple. And where does he take those artifacts from the temple? Back to Babylon, but not only to Babylon, he puts them in one specific place. The house of his God. Ancient warfare was not just a battle of armies. Ancient warfare was a battle of gods. Now the chief Babylonian god was a god named Marduk. And that was the house of his god that Nebuchadnezzar brings back these articles from the temple of Jehovah, and he puts them in the house of his god. It wasn't just because, that's a good storage place. I've got a nice closet there. No, that was to symbolize, to show my god, Marduk, is superior to this god of the Jews. My god has defeated Jehovah God. So I have taken the things from the temple of Jehovah God, and I have put them into the temple of my god. Babylon is successful militarily. That means Marduk is successful in defeating the other gods. There's a lot of these impressions given in this chapter. That's the reason for the name changes. And you look down at the names. So Daniel, if any of you have a son named Daniel, maybe you knew this already, but you named him Daniel, meaning God is my judge. El at the end of Daniel, that El is the suffix for God. El, Elohim. Okay, so God is my judge. Daniel's name was changed to Belteshazzar. Marduk protects my life. The Babylonian king didn't change their names just because he thought, oh, this sounds nicer. No, your name rejoices in your God. So I give you a new name. Now you'll rejoice in my God. Hananiah, the Lord shows grace. Okay, so the Lord here being Jehovah, the Ah at the end of it would be for Yahweh, Ah. Well, the Lord shows grace. Shadrach, the command of Aku, another Babylonian god. So you serve at the command of Aku. So Hananiah went from the Lord showing grace to now obeying the command of Aku. Mishael, again the El for God. Who is what God is? So it's kind of a question. Who is what my God is? Well, of course, nobody is what my God is. Meshach, almost the same name, except for who is what Aku is. Same name, but now about a different God. Azariah, the Lord, Yahweh, helps. Abednego, servant of Nebo. That is another Babylonian god. That's what you're supposed to be impressed with in this chapter. Babylon's won. And it would look like the Babylonian gods have won. Now, Daniel and his friends can't really do anything about their names. I mean, they could have just referred to each other by their Israelite names, but there's not a whole lot they can do when they're summoned to the king's presence, and the king looks at Daniel and says, Belteshazzar, and Daniel says, no, my name's Daniel. I mean, I guess he could have. I don't know how well that one would have worked. So there may have been some accommodation on that regard. You know, they did not rebel. They did not make that their, that what, you know, we're not going to cross that line. Although I do think it's significant that the text continues to refer to them here in chapter 1 by their Jewish names. So even when they're found to have been granted more knowledge and wisdom, it's as Daniel in verse 17, verse 19, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Okay? But Daniel crosses, or will not cross this line. And again, if the food, it's not just a matter of this is unclean. That would have been in complete defiance of the will of God. But it's also a matter of that food is given to your God. No, I'll not eat of it. We think of a 15-year-old boy. A 15-year-old boy. What he knows is he's a captive. He's been marched. Perhaps force-marched. 1,000 miles. He has been told over and over and over again, your God lost. Your God was defeated. Marduk reigns. Marduk is God. But Daniel still has faith. Now here again, when we talk about faith being the evidence of things hoped for, or substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, Daniel's a prime example. He still believes his God reigns. What evidence does he have for that? Doesn't look like his God reigns, does it? Looks like his God's losing. He maintains his faith. Does it look like God reigns today? What evidence can you give me for God reigning today? Maybe you might be able to find some, but it looks pretty dark out there. It looks like anything and everything else has supplanted God. Daniel would not defile himself. He still believed his God reigned. And I think that's one fantastic lesson in faith. Believing in that, even though what it would seem like evidence in our world would say to the contrary, I still believe my God reigns. Okay? Any questions about any of that? In the, yeah, go ahead. That's an interesting point that borne out by the entire Old Testament. The interesting thing about Daniel is if he's from a noble family, when you read the prophets, who did God scathingly rebuke more than anybody? It was the rulers. So, I don't know if it was Daniel's parents or, I don't know. It could have been, you know, he was told by somebody. You think of that famous passage in Judges, you know, a generation arose that knew not God, nor what God had done for Israel. That's kind of key there. It's not that they just didn't know who God was. They didn't know that God had delivered their people out of bondage. Daniel knew these things. And that's what, you know, kept him faithful. All right. This one is one, you know, the story makes pretty clear. I put it this way. I was studying Ephesians with the teen class here not that long ago. And Ephesians is perhaps, well, you don't want to say favorite letters. I really like Ephesians. And the reason why I like Ephesians so much is it's divided 50-50 between two things. The first part of Ephesians is all about here's what God did for you in Christ. Here's what blessings you have in the church. And there is no comparison to what God has done for you and I. The second three chapters is all about, now here's what you do. And as I put it here, good theology makes right practice. If you believe the right stuff about God, then that is actually going to be seen in your life. That is applied in your life. And that's how the apostles approach it throughout the New Testament. It's not a given law code. It's here's what your God has done for you. Now, if you appreciate and accept what your God has done for you, here's what kind of actions are required in response. Daniel believed his God ruled. He believed his God reigned. So he made up his mind. None of us do anything without making up our minds first. Some of you got up this morning at an insanely early hour and exercised. You only did that because you had set your mind to it. Okay, I'm going to do it. This does not at all.